You're listening to Work Tape, episode 162.
Welcome to this edition of the Work Tape podcast. It is your boy, Money Mitchell, Isaac Reuben Grover.
Peace to you, friends.
And we are continuing our deep dive and retrospective look into 2004. These albums are all turning 20 years old this year, which is pretty crazy to think about, just because I do remember a lot of these albums on, you know, the radio, and definitely listening to some of these albums as well. So them hitting their 20 year milestone is just kind of insane to me. Granted, I was in elementary school when a lot of this music was being dropped, so it wasn't like my taste for music and whatnot was nowhere near close to being fully formed, although I think there were definitely like some seeds that were still planted. But I do, like I said, remember a lot of this being played at the time and being popular. And such an example of that is this Gwen Stefani record, Love Angel Music Baby. It has Hollaback Girl on it, which was...
Say what you will.
Yeah, and it was definitely one of those just inescapable songs. Like, even if you were not necessarily the biggest fan of it, you couldn't deny how big this record was.
You know, it made it into Guinness Book of World Records due to its significance of its time. Yeah. So I remember that. And I believe I was reading a 2006 version. So I guess it had stayed there for at least a couple of years by that point.
Yes.
I'm sure that has definitely been dethroned. But yeah, that was kind of a big deal. I never really listened to Gwen, though. And later I got into No Doubt, and I always kind of preferred No Doubt. No offense, but
I could totally see that. I mean, that was,
I think a lot of people do, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that's the case with a lot of what I would consider to be like big true music fans, is a lot of them prefer Gwen with No Doubt than her solo record, because while the solo record got her immense popularity in a way that she may have not even had previously, especially with her teaming up with like Pharrell and I think even Dr. Dre had some production on the record too, which is kind of insane to think about. But obviously, while it took her to a new height in terms of popularity, it was not as well received by music fans. They definitely actually felt like kind of slighted in the sense, because basically she established herself as kind of this somewhat of like a critical darling, and No Doubt was kind of definitely, they were popular, they were big, but they had more of like kind of an independent type of following, since it was like the ska era of that time. You know, kind of, I think they were kind of coming right along, or maybe right after Sublime, I guess, because Bradley Noel died in the mid-90s, and then No Doubt kind of took over as, like, in my opinion, kind of the predominant ska band. So, a lot of people felt kind of slighted with Gwen Stefani coming out with basically just the straight-ahead pop music. They were kind of like, what? Like, you left No Doubt just to do this? Like, okay. So,
I mean, Hayley Williams did the same thing. To be fair with her, the band just kept splitting up. So, and she did, she never really abandoned Paramore, but with Gwen, I mean, that was pretty much an all out just kind of departure.
Yeah, which is really interesting too, because I think they did have a reunion at Coachella this year.
They did. Yes. We spoke briefly about that.
Yeah. So, who knows? There might be a bit of a resurgence or a revival of the band, especially with a lot of 90s stuff coming back around and doing huge numbers in terms of like 90s nostalgia revivalist type stuff. someone else who was also big in the 90s and the early 2000s who had a huge record, and we did mention this in the last episode, Confessions by Usher. Once again, another huge record. I said it before in the last episode that tracks like Yeah are like modern classics. They really are, at least to me. It's a modern classic. Like, say what you will about Usher as an artist, that he's kind of hit and miss in terms of the R&B category, but the man, especially with this album, definitely made some songs that stood the test of time in terms of especially R&B. I mean, you had, you know, Yeah, you had Burn on here. And then, of course, you had the title tracks as well. So all of them, as like I said, R&B classics. And he, what's really interesting about Usher is he took kind of a not so great situation in terms of a lot of his, you know, relationship wrongdoing being put out in public, and he kind of turned it around and actually was able to somewhat capitalize off of it. So there's definitely a lot of credit for that. He did a much better job with handling that than, say, someone like Robin Thicke, who put out, you know, Paula after he got split and the album was kind of creepy and weird and just not very good. Usher kind of set a blueprint in terms of, if you're going to do an album about some of the messiness of your relationships and some of the tabloid stuff, like, this is kind of the way to do it, is to, you know, write some good songs, but then write some stuff that's like for the club too. Cause I think that was the biggest thing, was that not only was there stuff on here that was more personal and more intimate for him, there was also some club bangers. So that's kind of what I think made it a significant record in that sense, is that you did have the balance. So
agreed.
Yeah. And then of course you have a lot of folk music as well at this time. Elliott Smith is somebody, along with Jeff Buckley, who he covered in the 1994 episode, that has seemingly just a huge amount of significance in the world of like singer-songwriters, and for good reason, because both Elliott Smith and Jeff Buckley, at least to me, actually have some similarities in terms of kind of odd chord progressions and different time signatures, whilst kind of delivering more introspective lyrics. And so Elliott Smith came out with From a Basement on the Hill.
Which was his last before his death.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what it was. It was originally planned as a double album, but unfortunately it had to be just a single album because he died in the midst of making it and basically wasn't able to finish it. So it was a very similar situation, like a la Mac Miller, a la Jeff Buckley, where they had a lot more music that was ready, or that was in the process of trying to become ready. And then both of their like unexpected deaths kind of delayed it and basically left, you know, some pieces to be picked up. It's kind of interesting. Like, I guess all three of them have somewhat of that like similarity, albeit Mac Miller is more of like the hip hop side of it. But with his later records, he kind of reflected a similar type of like intimacy and vulnerability of someone like Elliott, not necessarily like Jeff, because Jeff was a whole nother animal, but maybe like Elliott in terms of
More like cultural relevancy or a voice of a generation.
Yeah, for sure. Because I do know that there's a fair amount of folks who actually wouldn't have picked up a guitar if it wasn't for Elliott Smith.
Yeah, there's a Jay Dillon-ness as well there. I mean, of course, we could talk about the reason why each of them died, it kind of varies, but more or less the significance that came post their death is pretty comparable.
Yeah, no, definitely. Dilla, exactly. All of them have, you know, the type of thing where with all of their deaths, I mean, they were all kind of premature. So there definitely was like some kind of immortalization in a way, like from their, you know, deaths there. So another good one in the folk category is Sufjan Stevens. He's got great stuff always. I'm not as familiar with the Seven Swans record that came out in 04, but I do know that overall Sufjan's got some pretty good quality there.
Illinois was this big one, right? And wasn't that 05? I got to look this up.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Like I said, I'm not the biggest Sufjan fan. I think
05. Yeah, that'll be 20 next year. So that's his big one. But I agree. I like Sufjan, but I'm not gigantic in him either.
Yeah. And like I said, it's no like disrespect.
No, he's great, dude.
To the music that he makes, it's just I'm not as familiar with it. So I'm not going to be able to really speak on it as much as some. But an album I can speak on, and I think an album that you can also speak on, is what about this Toby Mac record? Welcome to Diversity. Why don't we talk about this for a minute?
Let's talk about this.
Because we have talked about, specifically, we've talked about Christian hip hop and whatnot. So
Toby's back.
Yes. So Toby Mac with Diversity. Yeah. This was at the time, at least to me, where you had actually a decent amount of crossover with Christian rock and hip hop artists that were able to make it on the mainstream charts. The biggest single off of this record is The Slam.
Yeah, that's like the more nu metal sound.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that was the one that was everywhere. I remember that was in like movie trailers. That was in like commercials.
That's true.
They put that in like a lot of action movies at the time, I think.
Yeah, those Matrix-y type movies.
Yeah, I want to say I remember seeing like a trailer for like The Transporter or something.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Jason Statham.
Statham. I can't do his voice, but... no, I mean, basically The Slam was POD as well.
Yeah.
I like this record. I think it's kind of cool because you had a good bit of gospel as well. What was it? I totally forgot the name of it. But no, this one it was a very eclectic mix. I don't remember if this is the first one where he features his son in it, but he has collabs from his son. He has collabs from, he did also do Atmosphere with DC Talk.
Right.
So that was kind of an interesting thing.
Right. Yeah. Toby Mac is a bit all over the place in terms of his sonic palette, because like I said, on one hand, you'll have something like The Slam or even like Boomin that came later in his career, which had more of that like nu metal rock rap type of sound.
Mm-hmm. The title track actually is really good too. That's the really gospel-y number I'm talking about.
Yeah. But then he has some stuff that sounds like, I don't know, Christian Justin Timberlake at times too, which is like just very interesting.
Oh, Burn For You is also pretty big. The remix was a pretty big single on Christian radio. But no, this whole album is very good. It's very consistent. I mean, the only reason why you wouldn't like it is because of the allegedly religious undertones. So
yeah, but you had an interesting point as well with comparing some of it to POD, Payable on Death, which is the group that came out of San Diego with more of the, although I feel like POD was definitely still more of like the nu metal.
You're right.
Hip hop rock type of sound. I mean, they did diverge a little bit later in their career to do like some more expansive type stuff. I think I actually remember POD at one point, like trying to sound like Mastodon, which was really interesting.
I would say so. I wouldn't really hate it, but I'd also be like, okay, that kind of piques my curiosity a little bit.
Yeah, I think there's a song from them on one of their later records called like Lost and Forever, which sounds like a Mastodon song.
Oh, and Mastodon's on this as well with Leviathan. I know we were going to get to that, but yeah, actually, come to think of it, Leviathan, that has that same sound, not like new metal necessarily, but in a way, if your parents, first off, your parents homogenize everything that you're listening to when you're young. So I guess that's not a good example. But if you were to not hear the lyrics and you were like separated by a few rooms and you heard Mastodon playing on a playlist of new metal, you would almost kind of mistake them for the same genre.
Yeah.
Because they were using more or less the same sounds.
Yeah, no, definitely kind of like true heavy metal. I mean, the thing is I feel like Mastodon definitely falls under more of like thrash and sludge, where it becomes more, they're actually pretty groovy. A lot of their stuff is pretty groove based.
Blood and Thunder from this album, Leviathan, is obviously the big one.
Yeah.
I think it's really impressive. And what's really indicative of this genre is that they're typically pretty dirty. And so I always kind of am like intrigued. I'm like, there's not one dirty word in Blood and Thunder. So I've always been impressed by, to a degree, their radio friendliness. Because as a kid, I think you and I were kind of raised in that area where we couldn't like just listen. I mean, I couldn't just listen to anything. Or my parents didn't really care too much. I just kind of stayed away from it. And so when I heard Blood and Thunder for the first time, and by the way, it was through Need for Speed's Most Wanted in 2005.
Yeah.
So I found out about them through video gaming.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, this sounds like a really dark song. And it's just about Moby Dick.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I like Mastodon a lot. And
so,
you know, the Mother Load in 2014, they're really groovy, like you stated.
Yeah. I want to say that my introduction to Mastodon was through the world of gaming too. And I believe it was,
okay,
I think it was Guitar Hero, where they had Sleeping Giant, which came, I think, from the album that preceded Leviathan. I think Sleeping Giant is off of Blood Mountain, which is the album that came after this. But yeah, Mastodon is really dope because, as I kind of mentioned, they're more groove based. They have really great musicianship. But the other thing too is they do have a bit of like a progressive type of sound as well, very much like a la a Dream Theater.
Yeah, very Dream Theater-y, yes.
But I think I prefer Mastodon even to Dream Theater in a lot of ways, because I do think that their musicianship is really great.
Leviathan's one of the most stand-up picks in this, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's very solid.
Most definitely. I mean, speaking of music that was, you know, a bit edgier to listen to, especially considering how old I was at the time, we're going to have a lot of that coming into rock here, especially with Green Day's in here, Velvet Revolver is in here, Taking Back Sunday is also in here, MCR. There's going to be a fair amount of stuff to cover here just in this indie and alternative side of things, just because, I mean, Modest Mouse is in here as well. I totally just overlooked that.
Yep.
So there was just a ton of stuff for more of the indie alternative side of things. But we're going to have to get to that in the next episode in order to really give the proper amount of attention to really cover all of that, because there is some big records in here, like even the Wilco Records, big Interpol, the self-titled Franz Ferdinand, Arcade Fire. I mean,
we have a lot of Wailing, and I mean Wailing frontmen in this list.
Yes. Yes. The Killers debut is in here as well.
Yes.
Which we've talked about a few different times, but
a reminder when things used to be good.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, it's definitely a lot before, you know, Brandon Flowers just decided that he was going to be a Springsteen cosplayer.
No,
and do musical cosplay as Bruce Springsteen for the rest of his career.
No, I think Day and Age, even though I did like it, I liked it. I still think Sam's Town is peak Killers.
Yeah.
An unfortunate peak because they're sophomore, to be honest. Yeah.
Well, they didn't have the sophomore slump like so many, at least to me. Like,
oh, no. Sam's Town. I mean, while not as acclaimed as Hot Fuss.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Sam's Town is, oh, it's so good.
They weren't like a lot of bands who had, especially in the 2000s, who had, you know, a fire debut record and then just completely dropped off the face of the earth with the sophomore record. They actually had really consistent quality between the albums. And then, yeah, like Day and Age, people hated on it, but I
like it.
I found it to be okay. I mean, I do think that some of the lyrics on Human are a little questionable. like that chorus is just like a little questionable, but considering that I looked into the context of it and they said that they were really big about quoting, I think they were quoting Hunter S. Thompson on that song, who was a bit of a weird guy, just to say the least. He's the guy who is the basis for like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, you know, with Johnny Depp, where they're just tripping in Vegas. That's Hunter S. Thompson. So it's a little bit weird.
I like Day and Age. It doesn't make my top list like Sam's Town and Hot Fuss do, but you know, it's still one of those like I'll listen to it to take me back to that time.
Yeah, but once you get to like Battleborn, I'm kind of like
no.
I just can't do it.
The opener's good though. Flesh and Bones, that's pretty good.
Oh yeah, that is. There is some highlights on it for sure.
Yeah, but it's an album. Yeah.
And actually, to be honest with you too, I like Brandon's solo record, actually. I didn't think Brandon's solo record was that bad.
You mean the one with Can't Deny My Love on it from 2013?
Yeah, the Desired Effect.
Oh, Desired Effect, right. That was his sophomore, right? Because he did Flamingo in 2010, right?
Yes. Yeah, that was his follow-up. But I thought that was pretty good because
I agree. Sure,
there was some Springsteen on it, but there was also like the Cars and like Pet Shop Boys.
Tears for Fears, right?
Yeah. But we'll have to get more into Hot Fuss in the next episode because, like I said, it really deserves its own amount of time with some of these other records in here. Not to completely homogenize a lot of 2000s indie rock, but it really does deserve its standout time to really get into everything.
100%.
So this has been the Worktape Podcast. My name is Mitchell, Isaac Rubin Grover, and be good to one another and see you guys next time. Peace and love.
Stay out there and cool down. Peace.
Yes.